Welcome back to Canna Week, brought to you by New Frontier Data, where we deliver the week's top headlines in cannabis and hear experts weigh in on the impact these stories are having on the industry. I'm your host, Heather Wickline. Before we get started, if you are loving this podcast, please be sure to like, subscribe, and leave us a five-star review. It helps us pull up in the rankings. Okay, so today we're going to be talking about financing and accessing cash in the cannabis industry. Our first guest is, we're so excited to have her. She was named one of the 35 most influential women in cannabis in 2020. And in 2021, she was named one of the 10 women to watch for, industry luminaries and rising stars. She has advised both local, state, and federal governments across the U.S. on social equity in cannabis. And she serves on many boards in the industry and is the CEO and co-founder of the People's Ecosystem. Please welcome Christine De La Rosa.
Thank you for inviting me, Heather. Nice to see you.
Absolutely. And as always, I am always pleased to welcome back our Chief Knowledge Officer of New Frontier Data, Mr. John Caguia.
Delighted to be back, Heather. Thank you for having me.
Of course. Christine, you are such a well-respected person in this industry. Take us back to, I always just want to know the origin story. Like, what made you, was there a catalyst or some kind of event in your life that thought made you say, you know what, I'm going full, force into cannabis and going to make a difference?
Yes. I almost died in 2010.
Oh my
gosh. So I almost died of a pulmonary embolism while driving down the 880. People in the Bay will know what I'm talking about, from undiagnosed lupus. And that pushed me into a trajectory where I spent the next 5 years housebound, bedridden, and really, really sick on 11 medications. Five of those were opioids, plus a monthly infusion at the hospital. And for 5 years, I didn't get better. I got worse. And for 5 years, even though I was sitting in the origin of medical marijuana, I didn't go to those because as a person of Mexican descent, we were taught that to smoke marijuana was to be considered a lazy Mexican in the United States. So I never looked at marijuana as something that I would even consider to treat my illness. But after 5 years of prednisone and gabapentin and Oxycontin and all the things that I was taking, I thought this could not be worse. Like smoking some cannabis could not be worse. And so that kind of set me on looking into cannabis as an alternative medicine. I spent about 9 months doing that. And within 9 months, I was able to come up with a regimen that works for me, that allowed me to get off all 11 medications, allowed me to stop having to walk with a cane, allowed me to stop going to the hospital to get an infusion every month. And I could have easily gone back. I'm a database architect by trade. I could easily gone back to my old job that I had to quit because I couldn't work. But I was so mad. I was so mad that there was something in the world that was holistic that I had been taught was the devil's lettuce, right? And that I had not considered it for 5 years and spent 5 years pretty much bedridden and really sick because of the propaganda around that. And I thought there's so many other Latina women like me, because lupus affects Black and Brown women the most in the States, that were also going through the trauma and drama and stuff I was going through with my lupus diagnosis, that we're not considering cannabis at all because cannabis is the drug. That's what we were taught, my age group specifically. And that's actually how I decided to not go back to telecom, but to come back and start a cannabis business. That was the catalyst for me.
That is unbelievable. And I think there's more and more stories coming out, whether it's a personal story or a friend or a grandmother or a cousin that just doesn't fit the mold of a typical cannabis user, that they see how it's actually improved their lives in so many ways that it really, I think, hits home for a lot of people.
Yeah.
I have a good friend of mine whose husband had suffered from Crohn's for years, and she was in the emergency room with him. And I remember she said a nurse closed the curtain and said, "Have you ever considered cannabis?" And she said, "If I wasn't there to believe it, I would have thought my husband was just pulling my leg just because he wanted to smoke weed." But she said, he used to make his own wine. He used to be such a, and he couldn't drink alcohol anymore. He couldn't, do a lot of the things that he loved. And, just for fear of a flare up. And this was something that, it really changed him.
Yeah. So. Changed me, changed my whole life.
That's amazing. So tell us about the People's Ecosystem. What are you guys working on right now? And how did this kind of evolve? Because I know you have a co-founder and a great team.
Yeah. Well, we started in a closet. That's the truth. You go on our website, you'll see me in the closet where we had the first dispensary, because we were a legacy operator. We were an underground dispensary. People will say illegal. I will say legacy. But what we were basically trying to do was get medicine to people, because I just learned how to treat myself and I wanted to help other people. And so I thought, you know, 20 or 30 people that were in my lupus support groups, my chronic illness support groups, would come to me, and we had three strains that we had grown in the backyard, and we were like all like fancy. But in the first 3 months, we had 4,500 customers that had signed up for our collective. And we moved into a 300 square foot space above our t-shirt shop that was a loft. But that's when I really understood that it wasn't enough that cannabis was being legalized, but it was really important that women, LGBTQ people, Black and Brown people were representative in the dispensary, because we're having to go through way more to get to feeling okay to use marijuana. We're going through like, am I a lazy Mexican if I smoke this? Am I a bad mom if I use this? There's so much that you have to, if you don't have representation in your dispensaries or in your supply chain, people won't transition over. They'll just continue going to the corner guy, which is not a bad thing. I'm not saying anything bad about that, but I realized that we had to have representation, and that's how we decided to enter into the legal market in 2018. And then from there, we bought a dispensary in Oregon so we could learn how to do everything legal, because we did not do anything at that point that was necessarily legal. We didn't do metric. We didn't have tax. We didn't have any of that. So we went and bought that dispensary so that we could learn how to do it. And then we sold that dispensary and came back to California, because it's our home state. And so right now we have a delivery license in Oakland. We just got awarded our manufacturing, cultivation, and distribution licenses in Fresno. We have a couple of cannabis lines, a couple of CBD lines. We have a management company. We have an accelerator. We just do a lot of stuff, all centered around women and people of color, really centering that group, because there's so much great stuff in the cannabis industry that we don't always have access to. I mean, when we started, we had access to no capital. I was very lucky to be able to raise capital from friends and family in the first time, but a lot of people don't have that access, you know? So we kind of, you know, lift everybody. So if you're in our ecosystem and you're a supply chain, we try to buy from you, our vendor. We try to get all our vendors to go together to collectively buy, you know, product, because if you buy 50 pounds, you get a better deal than if you just buy 10 pounds. And it's really important for people to understand that, especially when we're talking about finances. If I was to buy 1,000 pounds this year at 10 pounds increments, I'm going to pay $237,000 in COA certificates of analysis. If I buy 50 pounds, the same 1,000, but in 50 pound increments, I'm going to pay $32,000 in COAs. What is that gap? That's a $200,000 gap. So every small business that has to buy product to create their products, they're spending $200,000 for that same 1,000 pounds that a large MSO is getting for 32,000. So how do we do scales of economy for smaller people, for smaller suppliers, vendors, companies?
Amazing. I feel like that just kind of fits in to the whole cannabis cultural, you know, like the kind of the culture that's around cannabis. John, any burning questions for Christine?
Yeah, I'd love to hear a little bit more about the people's ecosystem. So how do you find the companies that are the partners that have become part of the ecosystem?
Well, you know, we come out of the legacy market. So a lot of the people we already know from the legacy market that were transitioning or needed help transitioning, which we've gone through it, so we're able to help, you know, and we're able to help. We don't charge money because they don't have the money, like they're trying to transition in, but we can like sort of advise them, you know? So that's one way in which we find people we already knew from the legacy market transitioning into legal. But then we have a huge network here in California and New Mexico and even New York, where we get introduced to a lot of folks who are like, hey, this is our folks. And we're like, cool. And so like, you know, there's always a bunch of headlines, John, about like big M&A and this group and that group, but there's a lot of big headlines in the smaller, you know, the smaller tier. Like, nobody knows this, but the largest canopy in the United States until Glass House this year was 1 million square foot canopy in Central Valley, California, like in that area, owned by two Latino women. They have 1 million square feet. They were the largest canopy in the US, in the globe actually, until Glass House came. Nobody ever knew them. They didn't get headlines, you know what I mean? So we're very lucky to be kind of connected to the underground, and we know these people, and that's how they get into our ecosystem, because it's all of us helping each other grow in the industry.
I love that. I love it. I love it. Well, we're going to dive into a little bit more about raising capital like you had touched on. All right. So Marijuana Moment reported marijuana businesses could be listed on stock exchange and access financial services under new bipartisan bill. So the capital lending and investment for marijuana businesses would, in addition to freeing up the cannabis industry to access financial lending and investment opportunities, provide safe harbor for national security exchanges listing or planning on listing cannabis related businesses. So Christine, you touched on this a little bit, but can you give us a little more background on some of the challenges, you know, that some have faced raising capital for legacy operators in particular?
Yeah, I would tell you that, you know, legacy operators don't have books. I didn't have a book. I didn't write anything in an Excel spreadsheet. I didn't have a QuickBooks. So
wouldn't you be building an indictment against yourself if you were doing that?
Right. So when you're looking at legacy, you know, when I'm talking to financial institutions that are looking to, like, how do I invest in a legacy operator? I'm like, I totally get that you need that, but you're not going to be able to use the same metrics that you use with just like a coffee company that's looking for investment or one of those types of companies that are not cannabis related. But even though the legacy definitely is a barrier to entry for capital because you don't have the books, the largest and biggest barrier to entry is just that many legacy operators, myself included, don't look like the people that they're used to investing in. And so, you know, we saw that, I can't remember who came out with it. It was last year, but like 2.5% of all VC across all sectors, like, went to people of color, and women of color below was like less than 1%. So there's a whole thing. So it's not just like, oh, we're coming out of legacy and that's a problem. It's also that we're Black, we're Brown, we're Indigenous, we're women. And these are groups that don't normally get access to that type of capital.
Yeah. Well, what are some creative or unique ways that, you know, organizations or individuals you found that had to like secure this funding or to invest in cannabis?
Well, you know, now it's much easier. Like back in the day when we started to raise capital in 2018, there wasn't MainVest, there wasn't Republic, there wasn't Fundana. Now, Fundana was around in 2018, but they only did real estate. So that's all you could do is real estate. They did not invest in any plant touching companies. Now, today, for the youngins, the new people coming up, they do have access to like a Fundana. They have access to a MainVest. They have access to Republic. So crowdfunding is really great. I love crowdfunding. I think using, despite what's going on in the crypto world right now, with the Coinbase and with the Ethereum and everything kind of falling down, still being able to use an asset-backed token would be another way to raise capital from a larger pool of investors that don't rely, you know, you're not using like something that's going to lower in value like an Ethereum, you're using a stable coin, right? So that's another way to be looking at that. When we first did it, like, we had access to none of that. There was no crowdfunding. So we ended up having to be really creative, and we created 6 different companies. We took in non-accredited and accredited investors into those 6 companies. You can only do 35 per company per year. So that's kind of how we got around, but we had to have 6 different companies. That was a lot to handle. And we ended up with 168 investors in that first round, both accredited and non-accredited. And everybody said to me, they're like, this is going to be so hard. It's a nightmare. And it has been hard, but I have to tell you, it's been worth it because 69% of those first investors were Black and Brown, and 65% of those investors were women of color. That's worth it to me. I'll take 168 calls a month if I have to. And I do sometimes. I mean, I have to talk to everybody. Everybody wants to know what's going on with their investment. So can you imagine? It's hard enough when you only have 5 major investors. Think if you have 168 people, that's a lot.
Unbelievable.
I don't recommend that though. Go to the Fundanas and MainVest in Republics of the world.
So for the businesses you're investing in, Christina, I'm curious, you know, what sort of dollar amounts are you talking about putting into these companies?
Somewhere as low as 750,000, upwards of 5 to 10 million. Mm-hmm. Depends. Like we have some technology that we're investing in, and that's a lower cost because technology doesn't require as much capital to create the actual, you know, application. But then when you have operating companies, they're much more, as you know, John, capital intensive. So like in Fresno, where we're going to have to stand up a manufacturing, distribution, and an indoor cultivation, like that's going to be about $3 to $4 million.
And does the people's ecosystem, as you're making these investments, also kind of participate in the management of the company?
Yeah.
Like how actively involved do you get into the business of operating the company beyond writing the check?
It really depends. Like for Fresno, they're a new group, so they need a lot of management. So we'll do a majority of the management there. But some of our investments are people that have been running their businesses quite fine. They just need some growth capital. And there we'll just sit on the board. And what we're really working with folks, and this might seem strange to some people, but when you're a new business owner, especially in this industry where you're not opening something like that's a small business, like a restaurant or a, you know, t-shirt shop or an art gallery, stuff that we did before, right? One of the things we still have this mindset, at least I did, I'm not going to talk for all people of color, but I've seen this and heard this from other people of color who own companies in this industry, is that the way that you spend money in cannabis is very different with how you, like in a regular small business, you're just like a budget. I make $8,000 a month. I use this for rent, use this, this, this. That's not how it works in this, in the world we're living in now. It's high finance, right? And we don't always have that background. So some people need management, not on how they manage their company, but how they use the money that they get either from investment or debt. And so that's what we can do. Like we don't need to be in there managing your day-to-day operations, but we do need to help you strategize. If you get $500,000, how to use that $500,000 to make it $2.5 million. What do you spend it on? Because some people will be like, well, I need to spend it on this, this, and this. And we're like, no, that's not creating any, that's not generating any revenue for you, right? Or some people will be like, I have like $60,000 in loans. I've got to pay that off. And we're like, no, you can't use investment money to pay that off. You need to create revenue so you can pay that off. But some people, you know, we don't think like that. I didn't think like that. Like I've learned that in the last 5 years.
Is the capital you're investing being allocated in equity or debt, or are you doing?
We have both, actually. We both do equity and debt. I'm really excited because, you know, in California, as with many places, if you own any part of the supply chain, you can invest in testing labs. It's against the law, right? And that's the way it's in California. But one of my favorite investments, which is not an investment, it was a debt facility, was a 100% BIPOC-owned testing lab in Davis. They could not get to the licensing because they kept running out of money. So the very first money I called in for the fund, I gave it to them as a debt because I can't invest in them. But what I was able to do with them was to bring them as part of the ecosystem. And the ecosystem operates like an MSO, as if we're part of a vertical. So we get preferred pricing when we go to testing. And they just got their license last week. So let's shout out to Spectrum. Woo! They were actually our first deployment of capital. And they're the only BIPOC-owned licensed testing lab in California. And it is, I love this, a Filipino gentleman, Mexican gentleman, African-American woman. They are badass and they're about to kill the game. But if they hadn't been able to access the capital that we had, they probably would have lost steam and not been able to get to licensing. And so for stuff like that, we did a debt facility. But then we also have investments where we've just invested in smaller companies. And we think about how it fits into an ecosystem. I always tell people I'm building the largest MSO nobody's heard of. Because we don't do stuff where we buy everything and it becomes the people's ecosystem. We don't do that. We invest in people that join the ecosystem, give us preferred pricing, help us do things. Like we have our vertical license in New Mexico, right? We partnered with somebody in New Mexico, but now we're able to take everything that we're building, all of our SOPs for the cannabis line that we have here in California and transfer it to her and her business so that we can also sell the same thing in New Mexico. And so when you look at like the way M&A works right now, M&A, they just kind of buy each other up. They do restricted stock. There's no cash. There's no nothing. They're just become one big thing. They're behemoth. And while I appreciate that as a strategy, my strategy is that when we're done, when we harvest the entire ecosystem, including our partners, not necessarily our investment, just they can be partners, that everybody will get a really good payday. Because if you're in contract with me for 10 years, and one of the larger companies, and I'm talking even MSOs, I'm looking towards like a Constellation, an Altria, the big guys at Federal, they'll either have to honor those contracts or pay out those contracts. But either way, my supply chain gets paid, regardless of whether I invested in them or not. And that's how you affirm that you're going to have small businesses, hopefully, in that supply chain after all of what's going on now has gone. And we are now at a Federal legislation and federally run. That's my dream. My dream is that we make sure everybody does really well. I'm sorry, I'm getting emotional because it's been such a long journey for us to get to this, like, you know, just from a strategy perspective, you know, and I don't think there's anybody else in the industry that can do what we're doing because we are connected to our communities. Like a lot of the stuff that we do is off-market deal flow because it comes to us very proprietarily based on our reputation, based on what we're doing. That's why we don't announce all the time, every time when we've invested in somebody, like a lot of the other funds do. And not because we don't want to tell people, but because we're building this larger thing. Like it's not just the one group over here that we invested. It's how does that group interact with all of the other groups so that we are competitive in this market, which, you know, is very competitive. You know, I answer the question. I'm just curious because I feel like I'm not answering the question.
It really stuck out to me when you said, like, just like you're building a community. You know, you're not building this, you know, MSO or this like behemoth. It's really a community that you're all working together and all raising each other up, which I love. So another question just about as far as listing on the stock exchange, what sort of impact would listing cannabis related businesses on stock exchanges have for, you know, individual investors or just the industry writ large?
I mean, it would be so awesome. Are you kidding me? Not. I mean, I remember when we first tried, people were like, go to Canada, you can get on these exchanges. And I was like, that sounds not right. Like, I didn't know very much, but I was like, that's not for us. But can you imagine, we're in a tipping point in the US. And can you imagine if you say, here on the stock exchange is cannabis companies, period, like just period stop. But then you say, here's a cannabis company that is majority BIPOC women owned, the majority of its supply chain is women, BIPOC, LGBTQ, the majority of its products, all of those things. And you look at who's coming up in Gen Z, Gen Alpha, who are really interested in investing in companies that align with their values. That would be literally like opening the floodgates to capital for companies like mine. And so that would be really important. Like it's going to open up capital for like all the big guys too, but there's a whole sector of people trying to find us and they can't. Because we're not on a stock exchange. And I think it gives us a lot more validity to be publicly traded. I mean, it gives the companies a lot of headaches too, right? That's not an easy thing. You now report to a much higher, you know, group of people when you're public, but I think it allows for people to really invest in their values. And I think that would be big for companies like mine.
Well, if you're already reporting to 167 investors, I think.
I know, right? I feel like I'm I'll tell you, when the pandemic hit, I took 168 calls because people were like, what's happening with the company? Are you going to go under? Like the beginning of the pandemic, nobody was safe. I mean, nobody. Everybody was like, and we were small, but even like the Deltas and American Airlines of the world were like, what's going to happen? Like, we didn't know. It was such a scary time. And I did have to take every one of those calls and be like, I don't know what's going to happen because we just got put on lockdown, but we're still thriving. We're still selling in our dispensary in Portland. We're still moving. But yeah, that was 2020 was a rough year for everybody, you know?
Yeah. John, anything to add or any insight on the impact of listing cannabis related businesses?
Maybe just a related question. I'm curious in your perspective, Christine, about how you think about the outlook for federal reform. You know, and the impact that that's going to have on these state markets, the state-run businesses. How are you thinking about and preparing for the growing possibility that sometime over the medium term, we'll see some pretty sweeping and disruptive federal changes?
I mean, my hope is that that's soon. I mean, I don't think it is, but I still have hope. The biggest issue and what I'm working on right now with another group is with the SBA. Because when you look at all private equity and you look at all VC capital and you look at all loans, the SBA is like the godfather or the godmother of that. They have access to a lot of funding. And we feel like the SBA would be instrumental and game-changing for small businesses. So what we're really looking, what I'm really focusing on, besides the FDA stuff, I'm really focusing on SBA to be able to do those grants and loans like they do for other small businesses. And that's why for me, federal regulation is so important because I don't want small businesses and even mid-tier businesses to become extinct in the craziness that is the cannabis industry M&A right now. I want them to be able to, there's a place for us. There's a place for small businesses in the cannabis industry, but having access to like normal SBA would be awesome. But the thing we're really working on with the SBA right now is that they have to understand that there has to be a different way in which they determine who gets those funds, because the current way that it works doesn't work in the cannabis industry. You can't be like, oh, if you were incarcerated, you can't apply. You can't do that in the cannabis industry, because there are people that are incarcerated that actually are going to have, you know, businesses. So we have to remove that as one of the things. If you say something like, oh, you have to have 5 years of historicals and you're coming out of legacy, you're not going to have that. If, even if you come out now. So trying to get them to choose other kind of credit worthiness data than what they currently use, what the banks currently use. Because, you know, SBA does it through banks, and banks have no idea how to give out loans or investments to this group of people who are going to own some part of the industry. So really working towards that. And I think federal legalization opens up a whole other group of funding that is not, you know, predatory, which is what we're dealing with right now.
Well, before we, go ahead, John.
No, just talking about on this idea of the predatory nature of capital markets right now in cannabis, with no access to conventional sources. You know, we know people paying 30, 40, 50% interest loans because that's the only money you can get in the market.
Yeah.
It's really, really difficult.
Yeah.
Well, Christine, any other thoughts or predictions or expectations for cannabis financing for the remainder of 2022?
Well, I think that we're seeing a lot more, at least is what I'm seeing, a lot more people wanting to use debt instead of equity, right? Because of the way the markets are right now, we saw a huge shift. Like, it was really weird. I went to like this one family office event like in February, and people were talking about equity and like what they could get. And by April, the same family office had another meeting where they're like, yeah, we're doing all debt. We're just going to do debt. And I was like, you could see that. And it was such a fast shift. So now, as we're, you know, advising, including my group included, but as we're advising our investors that we're advising companies, we're like, don't be afraid of debt, but understand how much debt you can actually take on that doesn't jeopardize your business. Like, you know, somebody might be like, I'm going to give you $10 million in debt, but you're only making $100,000 a month. So probably not a good plan for you, because they might be able to confiscate your equipment, your licenses. So I think that that's the biggest shift that I see that's going to continue through 2022, through the midterms. I think the midterms, people are real antsy about that. And I think people are kind of waiting to see what's going to happen. They're going to see if we end up going into, and John, I'm not a finance person, so I'm going to ask you, what's the market we are in now? Is it a bull or a bear?
It's shaping up to be a pretty rough bear market.
Yeah. So as we go into 2023, what my financial advisors are saying, we're probably going to see debt here rather than equity for quite some time, unless for some odd reason the federal government starts to move on cannabis. But I don't see that happening this year at all. What do you think, John?
I agree with you on the first part. It's been interesting to watch how dramatically some of these economic indicators have shifted over the past few months. I think your family office conversation is a perfect illustration of how people have gotten a bit of whiplash by, you know, the early spring looking like, you know, all systems go, late spring suddenly things looking quite grim and quite grim for the foreseeable future. Are we likely to get sweeping federal reform on cannabis soon? I don't think so, but it would be interesting. So like the proposed bill that we're talking about here, you know, in some respect, because of the nature of cannabis, it's almost like you don't necessarily need the full sweeping measure for there to be things that can open up the market. So if this is if you open up the market to retail investment, like this bill would do, by allowing companies to go public more readily, then maybe that gives companies who might have not, or for whom the burden of going public in Canada might have just been too big and complex and costly, maybe gets them to reconsider that as an alternative source to go and raise money. A tough time to be listed as a public company, but if you're doing well, if your business is solid, and as we have seen, cannabis consumer demand continues to be very strong, despite.
And even stronger now as we're in this uncertainty. I can tell you from personal experience, like, we're seeing an uptick in our sales because people are afraid. Like, they're like, what is happening right now? What's going on? You know?
No, for sure. And we talk a lot about this idea of, you know, cannabis may not necessarily be recession proof, but it's certainly recession resilient. You know, so for companies that are looking to raise money, this is actually going to be one of the few sectors in a broader economic downturn where you can say, you know, the demand is strong and is actually growing in some instances. And so for investors who have a moderate level of risk tolerance and are looking for what are going to be very strong long-term growth opportunities, this is actually a good time to be able to get into cannabis if you can connect particularly some of these lower dollar retail investors to companies that align with their values and
investment objectives. I do think those retailers, I think they would be really excited to be part of this investment community, but they just don't have access to it yet.
Amazing. Well, Christine, thank you so much for being here. Before we go, we allow all of our guests a moment to give a shout out to someone in the industry that you think is doing something amazing or inspiring. So the floor is yours.
Well, you know, I always have to do a shout out to my own COO, Melanie Davis. She is the person that got the licenses in New Mexico. So we're partnered with her. She's also just recently been appointed the DEI chair for the Trailblazers group. So that doing work there, she'll be in New York at the end of July. So I'm just super proud of her because she jumped in at a time in my company where we really needed somebody to just start swimming, like Dory says, just keep swimming. And she did that. And she's made a name for herself in the industry, very proud of her and proud of her DEI work and her social justice work.
Amazing. Amazing. Well, thank you both so much for being here. Thank you for your time. And thank you to our listeners at Canna Week. Again, please be sure to like, subscribe, hit the notification bell. And if you really like us, leave us a 5-star review. And if you haven't already, check out we have released two new reports recently on newfrontierdata.com. You can look under industry reports. We have it's a millennial report. And then John, what was our most recent one? I think it just got released.
The flower report.
Yes, the power of flower.
Trends and the demand, the consumer attitudes, behaviors, and use of flowers. So really, really deep dive into flower, which remains the king of the cannabis consumer product ecosystem.
Love it. Well, head on over to newfrontierdata.com. You can download it for free for a limited time. I am your host, Heather Wickline, and we will see you next time.
New Frontier Data provides this podcast for entertainment purposes only. Nothing stated in this podcast should be taken as legal or financial advice. Reference to any specific product or entity does not constitute an endorsement or recommendation by the company. The views expressed by guests are their own, and their appearance on the program does not imply an endorsement of them or any entity they represent. Views and opinions expressed by New Frontier Data employees are those of the employees and do not necessarily reflect the view of the company or any of its officials. If you have any questions about this disclaimer, please contact our legal department.